This is the operator. Just need to inform all participants that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would like to introduce your host for today's conference. We have Ms. Glenn de St. Jerry. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you very much, Lori. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. This is the PEDNR teleconference on the 6th of April. And on the line we have Tatiana Kamkowski, Siva Mutasami, Cheryl Langdonor, Ron Wickersham, Mason Cole, Alan Greenberg, Jeff Eckhouse, Mikey O'Connor, Michele Nilon, Paul Diaz, Barry Cobb. And for staff, we have Margie Milam and Glenda Senshoki, myself. Thank you, Alan. Over to you.
Thank you very much. All right. On the agenda today, our initial major task will be to continue review of the survey from where we left off last time. I also just sent out by email a sort of a one-line summary of the previous answers, and perhaps if Margie can get that in a form where we can post it on the on Adobe towards after we finish the review, we can look at that and see if people feel it's a reasonable and fair summary of where we are today or where we were at the start of the meeting. It can just be put into a note field, it's just plain text. And at the end, I would like to spend some time on discussing what we're going to do for Brussels, if it's possible to get a report pulled together so that we can have an information session and feedback there, and if so, what do we have to do to actually make that happen, since the time is moderately short. And I was distracted by a message saying Michele is entering the room. Welcome, Michele. In the virtual room. Does anyone have any other issues on the agenda? And if not, I'd like to go immediately into the review of the survey starting at 28, where we left off. But in the back of your minds, if you can keep the idea of what do we do for Brussels and how do we get something put together in that time frame. At the same time, preferably not having meetings which unduly load us down in light of the vertical integration PDP, which a lot of us are involved in. All right. In the absence of any comments, Margie, if we can... Do we each have control of the scrolling here? We do.
You can each scroll through the document.
Okay. So we're going back to page number... 5. And question number 28. Margie, if you could sort of go over what the questions are and the summary of the answers, and then we'll take questions and comments on each one.
Oh, sure. You want me to read them?
Sure.
Okay, I will do that. So we're on number 28. Should further details be provided on when or how these notices are sent? If yes, what further details would facilitate transparency and information while at the same time not restricting registrars from taking additional measures to alert registrants? And so with this question, it looks like we had a 53% in favor of this. And then 27% no, and then various other possibilities.
All right. Any thoughts among the excuse me, forgive the cough, among those who answered yes on what kind of ways should we try to do this, given the problems that we perennially have with simple email? All right, I have a couple. One of the things that is not clear is we have talked before about using things as ranging from telephone calls to paper mail to fax to SMS. And one of the issues there, of course, is cost. And is there any, do we have any mechanism, either through registrars or any other ideas, on getting a measure of how many, what percentage of domains actually get to the process where we are post-expiration and the issue of how to contact the registrant comes up? Because clearly, if only 1% or a tenth of 1% of domains get to that point, then the cost issue is not as great as if it's a much larger percentage. No thoughts? Yep, Paul?
Yeah, thanks, Alan. Unfortunately, I don't have stats like that at my fingertips, and it would take just a little while to get it ready. I can, I guess, inquire, come back to the group. Just a general question, though. We have two decks that were presented, right? And at least what we were working off last week, Marika had reordered them in terms of those questions and concerns that had more consensus as opposed to going in numerical order. If I jump back, and that's fine, but if I jump back, so 28 falls on basically 26, really. The 27 in between was just asking for additional comments. But the question that proceeds, or I guess that this one really falls up on, our notices post-expiration required. And then it said, should further details be provided on when, how these notices are sent? So I just asked because, you know, we had a very similar distribution in terms of whether the notices post-expiration should be required.
Yeah, we talked about that a little bit last week because we started getting into this question, and then we ran out of time. The answer at that point, and I went over the transcript yesterday, so I'm moderately familiar with it, is that although this question physically followed the one on post-expiration, the intent was, when we originally wrote it, was that we were talking about the pre-expiration notices, or not exclusively about the post-expiration ones.
Okay, pre. Okay.
Well, pre and or post, if for those who send them. I think the intent was that we were saying, since we have problems with email, are there other techniques that could be used? How else could notices be sent to be effective?
Okay, and not to be difficult, but it's like how could is different than how should, right? So again, it kind of drops me back into the, this is an opportunity for certain registrars to kind of differentiate themselves in the marketplace. We're all required to have those two notifications. How exactly you do it, and if you do more or less, and in particular, what may be done after expiration, is sort of a market differentiator.
I think that's a fair statement for this, yes. But from my point of view, and I'll take off my chair's hat, from my point of view, it is worthwhile exploring what the possibilities are and then present them as, perhaps in this case, best practices is a good way to phrase it, since we are not necessarily going to require that everyone send out a courier to knock on the door. But if it's viable from a financial point of view, then it may well be something we can identify as a possibility. And I give that one as a stupid example. McKaylee?
The short answer is no, it's not viable. I mean, the thing is, unless you're going to say that people, that registrars can differentiate themselves by doing different things is one thing, but trying to mandate a best practice in this area is nuts. I mean, the thing is that, you know, we sell domain names at one price, other registrars sell them at another price. The margin that we sell them at is based on our business model. So, I mean, by putting something in here, you're basically asking us to reinvent our business models, which I think is ludicrous.
I guess I wasn't looking at it from that point of view. I was looking at it from a point of view of what ways are there that one could do something, and then you can choose to evaluate them in your business model whether it's viable or not.
Yeah, but I mean, but Alan, that's leaving it. That's such an open question that it actually becomes a non-question.
Okay. Anyone else have any ideas? Anyone who answered yes, who's on this call? Do you have any thoughts on what kind of things were you thinking of when you said yes? I'll pick on Cheryl since she's one of the people I recognize in the list.
Oh, I'm looking in there to remind myself of the thrill-packed and exciting exercise of going through all of this. The yes from me would have been an in principle. If there is something that is viable and reasonable, then, you know, why not do it? But I certainly wasn't thinking of it as a best practice model, or indeed from making it some sort of mandate.
Yeah, I just checked. Your comment, in fact, was we need substantive discussion on this.
Thank you.
How do we generate substantive discussion? Anyone else who answered yes have any thoughts on where we should go with this, or is this one we just drop? There was a majority of people who said yes. We, you know, there should be some further work on this. But apparently not on this call.
Well, it's not a matter of on this call, Alan. Cheryl here. I think it's a matter of if all right, I said we need more discussion. Am I the only one who said that? You know, maybe we don't need to drop it or deal with it, but rather see what people said and then move to the next bit. And if people said, let's come back to this and look at it, so be it.
Ron?
Yes, thanks. The question was about the notices being sent. And since there's nothing other than two notices, additional details does indicate that we do, you know, answering yes said, yes, the current stated requirement is not sufficient. So, yes, additional measures such as when the spacing and how many notices would be a minimum, since we can't dictate a good practice or whatever. So just saying a minimum, sending one out, that discussion would increase transparency and information to the registrant. So I don't know that there's a lot other than this. This would just say that, I mean, otherwise, if you're answering no, should further details on the notices not be sent, then that's, I don't think that's been the nugget of what all our discussions have been. I think almost everyone has said that, as stated, it doesn't guarantee very much. So I don't think discussing it within the context of this question is where the details are likely to come out, because it's so broad here, but the details will come out in other questions. So I'm not too worried if we don't get details specifically from this question alone.
All right. I guess I'm just worried on how we proceed on this, because if you look at the previous question of the previous one, of are two notices sufficient, some of the people who said yes, two notices are sufficient also said we need further detail. We should provide further details. So I'm just trying to understand how one goes forward. All right, if the general feeling is we don't need to pursue this a lot further at this point, but it may come out of other places. Yes, go ahead.
Alan, this is Barry.
Yeah.
You know, I think, to me, what is missing here, you know, it's all about the question of, you know, should notices be sent? Yes. Then if yes, how many? Two seems to be the baseline minimum. We've got, you know, several of our registrar community that send 20 of them till you're almost notified to death. I think what we're really missing here, though, and I do respect what McKaylee had to say about business models and those kinds of things, but there is a segment of the registrar community that doesn't send any, and that's where we're really trying to target. And I don't know what the best method is about going about correcting that, but there doesn't seem to be enough language in the RAA to target specific compliance on this issue, but at the same time we've got to be able to correct the gap. Thank you.
Okay, Jeff.
Sure. I think that if there are, this is, I guess, towards Barry and just everyone, is that if there are registrars that you feel are not complying and are not sending any of the notifications out, then I think you should definitely contact ICANN directly and say, I have evidence that registrar XYZ has not been sending out notifications. I believe they're required to send two. I've not received any. Send it to the compliance group. And they have, you know, there's a budget for it. There's a team there. Let them handle it. I don't think that comes under the purview of this working group, that if they're not sending it, we need to correct it. That's something ICANN compliance needs to work on.
Any other thoughts on this right now?
And this is Barry, if I may respond. So
sure.
I believe what is been at contention within the group is exactly the wording within the RAA. It doesn't specifically say you have to send two, and correct me if I'm wrong, Alan, I'm not in front of my computer, so I'm kind of going off hazy memory, but the language was that was worded in such a way that it was implied that two had to be sent. Is that correct or not? Because I would agree, if it's black and white in the RAA that says two notices must be sent pre-expiration, then you're right. It's an absolute compliance issue, and then we should just move on, and we'll go find those that aren't in compliance.
The wording in the RAA is, and I'll quote verbatim, at the conclusion of the registration period, failure by or on behalf of the registered name holder to consent that the registration be renewed within the time specified in a second notice or reminder shall, in the absence of extenuating circumstances, result in the cancellation of the registration by the end of the auto-renew grace period, although the registrar may choose to cancel the name earlier. That is the sole reference to notices in the RAA.
And so this is Barry again. So, because I'm not a lawyer, and again, I'm not in front, I can't read the exact language specifically, but does that say, yes, registrars have to send two notices pre-expiration?
There is an implied reference to a second notice, therefore presumably there is a first notice. 67% of the people who answered that question said it was not, in our group, said it was not sufficiently clear.
Okay, so in trying to preserve registrar business models, and I'm just shooting out in left field here, so please knock it down whatsoever, but as a probable or possible solution, would it be that we would, as a group, could recommend that the language be changed so that it is just more clear that any registrar must send two notices pre-expiring? And would that significantly change business models here? And correct me if I'm wrong, is that what we're shooting for?
From my point of view, such a statement would certainly be clearer than what is there now. Mason, your hand is up.
I'd like to defer to Jeff and go second, if I may.
Sure. Sure.
Okay, thanks, Nathan. Yeah, I just want to respond to that. And I actually was one of the people that said on, is the provision sufficiently clear? My response was no. It's sufficiently clear to us at our company, and I think most people it's clear to, but I agree that it's implied. But, you know, if that's what, you know, we need to do for this working group to move on and say, hey, listen, we don't think the language is sufficiently clear. We'd like to clarify it. Then I'm okay, and I'd say let's just wrap that up and move on from it. You know, I don't think you're going to get a lot of opposition saying let's make it less clear. You know, some
we have some good lawyers among us. We might be able to do that.
I mean, listen, it's, you know, I'll just tell you the RAA, just in my opinion, it might not, that's, you know, and this was an issue I had with us taking this survey, is that it might not be sufficiently clear to everyone on this working group, but you know what? Not everyone on this working group is gone through the rest of the accreditation agreement, has dealt with the minutiae every day of dealing with the RAA, and I think that almost everybody here would have a lawyer or somebody read through it or somebody who understands contracts, and you wouldn't enter into this contract, into the RAA, without reading it, maybe having someone else read it. So, you know, no offense to, you know, some of the folks that are on this and saying, hey, it's not clear to me, but it's okay. I mean, I might not be clear with contracts in your business and the details of it, and I might have a lawyer look through it, just as if I would have an accountant look through my taxes and my IRS forms, because I'd like, you know, someone who knows the minutiae of it and the details. So that's why I'm fine with making it clear, but I think we might not be the audience to decide is it sufficiently clear.
Mason?
Yeah, I would agree with Jeff on that point. I want to go back to what Barry raised about registrars who are problems. If anyone in this working group has researched which registrars present problems to registrants in terms of not doing, you know, what they say they do or what they're obligated to do under any kind of interpretation, then, you know, I mean, even in my position as chair of the registrars, I would help contact those people and see if they can be persuaded, you know, to come up to industry standard. I don't necessarily agree that putting a new requirement across the board on all registrars, most of whom are fulfilling their obligation to register to end users, is the right way to go about it. I think if we're going to go after bad actors, we can go after them in a targeted way that doesn't impose unnecessary regulation on the registrars who are already doing what they should be doing.
Just out of curiosity, though, if one reworded the statement that I read out before to right now it's worded in a sort of backwards form, saying if the registrant does not do something in regard to the second notice that was sent out, which, as Jeff points out, any registrar who has read the RAA carefully understands that means you must send out at least two notices. Is there anything wrong with putting a clear statement in the RAA in a positive way to say you must send out at least two notices? Does that hurt anything?
I don't know. I don't necessarily know if it hurts anything. No, I don't know. You know, the RAA, I mean, this is sort of a current and sometimes sore topic with registrars right now, because there's a giant laundry list of things that lots of people want to put into the RAA, and the RAA is being used as a policy document when it in fact isn't. It's a contract. So I just want to caution, you know, the use of the RAA as a method of getting everybody's sort of wish list accomplished.
McKaylee?
Yeah, sorry, I was on mute. I mean, I'd agree with what Mason and Jeff were saying. I mean, personally, I don't have a problem with things being clarified if that helps people. And clarifying existing clauses within various policy documents or within the RDA so that it's clearer for people is fine. But, I mean, if there's something which is directly related to the RAA, then maybe this isn't the work group for that. Maybe this is something that should be just put, shunted across to the RAA work groups.
Alan, it's Barry. May I get in the queue?
Sure. Ron is there first, though.
Yes, yes, this is Ron. I'm confused. If the RAA isn't the place for policy, can someone point out where our policy deliberations should be directed then on this issue of notices? Where is that policy if not in the RAA?
Barry?
Thank you, Alan. Definitely to Jeff's point, and kind of thank you for slapping me correctly for this, because you're right about the audience for which the RAA is really only ICANN and the registrar community and maybe those that do develop the policies that try to change some of this stuff. Certainly, you know, my point of view is from the registrant perspective, and they, you know, maybe 0.0001% of them would ever seek to try to find out the RAA. So you're absolutely right, Jeff. The audience is the critical component to this for making this clear. So I guess I'd like to backpedal a little bit, and if there was any kind of motivation for change, what the registrants should be using is, or looking at, is the registrant agreement, and would it better benefit that we help improve registrant education by noting that in that registrant agreement that they will be getting two notices prior to expiration. And let's put aside the fact that most of them don't read the registrant agreement, but educating them, knowing some one way or another, I think we're going to be exploring other education avenues besides the registrant agreement in which we can increase their street cred or street IQ, if you will, but somehow that we're starting to disseminate that they can expect that they will be getting two notices pre-expiration and at such and such times and those things. So again, it's all about making it more predictable and setting the expectation from their perspective.
Okay, Mason was next. I also had put my hand up after. And Margie, did you want to interject something now or just be in the queue?
I'll just be in the queue.
Okay, Mason next.
All right. Yeah, there were several things that were addressed there. One is, generally speaking, there's an RAA process going on right now. If anyone in the community is interested in an update to the RAA, there is a specific work group that's taking input right now. That input will be given to ICANN staff. ICANN staff and registrars will negotiate a new agreement at a mutually agreed to time. So there are issues that are inside what's known as the picket fence that can be addressed in the RAA, and issues that are outside that fence, that's what the PDP process is reserved for. So generally speaking, when you're talking about changing the RAA, that's how it's structured. With regard to the registrant agreement, I generally agree that that's probably a smart place to focus at least some of our effort. I know, if you'll pardon the parallel, in a previous life I was involved in the mutual fund industry where you're obligated to send out prospectuses for investors to read before they invest. Very few people ever bothered to read it, but it's in fact the governing document between you and your investor. It's the same thing. The registrant agreement is a contract between the registrar and the registrant. Both are obligated to understand what's in it. You know, I don't know how many of our customers actually take the time to read it. But, you know, perhaps there's a place where we could set an expectation for, you know, what you could expect as a registrant. Maybe a registrar prefers to send an email to the registrant after a name is registered to say, here's what you should expect. You know, here's the best way to do business with us, and here are the things that you're obligated to do. You need to keep your who is current. You need to look for emails from this address because that's your renewal notice. And, you know, we'll do everything we can to keep you as a customer, and you know, but you have to hold up your end of the bargain as well.
Okay, thank you. I had two comments. Number one, regarding the RIA revision process, we have a fair amount of overlap between that group and this group, and I think it's been generally agreed upon that things that are under our purview we can certainly propose, and things which are within the picket fence of consensus policy are things that we could look at. Now, it may be more expedient to toss it over the fence to the other group, and I think when we get closer to recommending any policy, if we get to that point, that we may well do that. But at this point, both groups understand that things are being talked about in parallel in both groups. At least I'm not on the other group, but I believe that's the case. And if someone else can correct me if I'm wrong. The second part I wanted to mention is going back to the origins of this group, a lot of the problems have occurred on the from the point of view of on resellers. And although implicitly registrars are responsible for their resellers' behavior, the resellers may not be quite as conversant with the RIA as Jeff is. And clarity on the RIA from that perspective may well help things. I think Marjorie was next.
Yeah, I was going to comment on the RIA process. What we've been doing on that group, since I work on that group as well, is we've been designating issues that are within the picket fence and appropriate consensus policy versus those that aren't. And I know on this issue, I think we've stepped aside on this issue because this group is working on it. So I think that group had made at least the initial observation that they should stay away from the post-expiration issues because this group is working on it.
Okay. Sorry, one other thing I was going to mention. A reference was made earlier to using ICANN compliance. In fact, earlier in this working group, when we did the registrar survey, we identified some terms in registrant agreements, which were in fact not compliant. And we did, Marika did go through compliance to alert them, and I believe that problem has been rectified. So I think that problem, that method is understood. Mason, is your hand still up, or is that a...
No, sorry. No, my fault.
And Cheryl, did you want to say something? You had a hand up at one point.
Yes, I had a hand up, but it was picked up to a lesser extent by you, but by Margie quite specifically, and that was to point out that Michaela and I did definitely bring up in the RIA work groups that we're in that there are bits and pieces that this work group, which predated the others, were active on, and that there was going to be a risk of overlap and that we were to avoid that. So if Mason is suggesting it gets tossed to the other group needs to know about it because at the moment it's left it alone.
All right. Unless there's anyone else have any more comments on this one item we decided not to discuss much, we spent a lot of time on, and perhaps we can go on to the next question. 23, Margie?
Sure. Okay, 23. We've touched on this a little bit. Is a minimum of two notices sufficient? And we have a 53% said yes, 27% said no, and then no strong view either way had 13%. And then there was also a 7% other, but I don't know what the specification was on that.
We can quickly look it up, unless Ron remembers what he said. Ron's note was, as was pointed out in meetings, two notices that would conform sent within the last 5 minutes of the term would not be deemed sufficient by most registrants. So the point being the timing of the messages of the two messages is relevant. Any other thoughts on that one? Nothing? Then let's go on to 30.
Okay. 30. Should additional measures be implemented to ensure that registrants are aware that if their contact information is not up to date, they most likely will not receive notices or reminders? If yes, what kind of measures should be explored? And that had 53% yes, 13% no, 20% no. Okay. And there was a other please specify. It is difficult to check the availability of information.
I think this is a good one that when we get to the point of writing a report and looking for comments from the community, to look for input for as to what methods do they think might be effective in alerting people when email clearly is not always. In the absence of any other comments, let's go on to 9.
Okay.
We're now approaching the numbers where there was no majority for any given position.
Okay. Should the redemption grace period be adopted as a consensus policy for GCLD registries? We've got 47% saying yes, 20% saying no, 27% saying no strong view either way, and then an other. And the other is they might argue that it has already been. The question is more to do with the billing side of it, so it might need to be rephrased.
I would question whether I think that was McKaylee who said that. I would question whether that's the case. Certainly for the existing registries, it has largely been implemented. But given that it's not a consensus policy, it's not at all clear that it will be implemented for the unknown number of GTLDs that might be created over the next N years. I don't know if that changes anyone's perspective or not. No hands? No comments. Then let's go on and we'll address that in the report. 19?
Okay, 19. Are you of the opinion that adequate notice exists to alert registrants of upcoming expiration? And we had a 47% yes, 27% no, 7% no strong view either way, and then three others. And then the responses were most well-known registrars make such notifications, and then someone said sometimes yes, sometimes many times no.
Any strong feelings on this requiring discussion at this point? Then let's keep going.
Sorry. 46. Should a transfer of domain name registration during the auto-renew grace period be allowed without a requirement to renew the registration first before being able to transfer it? And we have 43% saying yes, 21% saying no, 29% saying no strong view either way, and one other.
Well, the other comment is interesting, and maybe Jeff wants to comment. The comment is it's already allowed, and that was my recollection also, that it is both allowed, and ICANN in the recent couple of years has reminded registrars of that.
That's what I'm told.
Yeah, it's Jeff here. It's 100%. It is. I don't see that. I didn't even understand why. Yeah, I mean maybe. I'm sorry, I don't have the specific point in front of me, the language, but it's probably in the transfer policy, that language. But it's 100% allowed, and you're right, Alan. It is.
That's why I thought. Although, if I recall from Rob Hall's presentation, he said implementing it may in fact be difficult because of the that some registrars change the whois information. And therefore, it's not clear, based on the whois information from the registry's point of view, who the registrant is. But other than that, I believe technically it is supposed to be allowed.
No, it is. And this is another one. If you do find out that there are issues with it, I would talk to the compliance team about that.
Yeah,
I know they're actively working on transfer policy issues.
All right. So it sounds like that question was misplaced and shouldn't have been here to begin with. Unless anyone remembers a subtle reason for it being there. If not, let's go ahead, Margie, on 38.
Okay, 38. As a subset of question 35, should the domain be allowed to resolve directly or indirectly to the original IP address after expiration? And we've got quite a mix here on this one. We've got 20% yes, 36% saying no, 30%, 29% saying no strong view either way, and then 2% saying other. Please specify. And let's see if I can find the other. I guess it says no because this is often the most effective means of getting the attention of the registrant that their attention and action is required. Another comment is at the discretion of the registrar at expiration, in effect, services to the registrant are legally concluded. So I guess, Mason, that's probably your comment, that it should be at the discretion of the registrar. And then someone else said domain does not resolve, only hosts resolve.
Not quite sure what that means. I thought the term DNS resolving a domain name is in fact the appropriate wording. Michaeli. Michaeli, you're on mute.
Sorry, having problems with the buttons on this thing. No, it's a technicality. Host names resolve, domains don't. It's actually correct. So it's just that I think it depends on which way you look at it. As in that a domain could be in the root,
okay.
But it might not. But if there are no hosts specified for the domain name, it won't
Got
actually
it.
Resolve. It's the hosts themselves that resolve.
Got
it's just it's just splitting hairs. To be honest, I wouldn't. Worry about it. It is technically
so should
correct.
We ever use this question again, we should be careful to word it properly. So the intent.
Well, it's like with some of the other questions, though, to be perfectly honest. I mean, there's questions here that unless you have dealt with every single registrar and every single possible scenario, you can only answer based on your own experiences. Which, the way that some of the questions are worded, it expects you to have some kind of omnipotent view of the world, which makes it rather difficult.
I'm not sure I understand what you're saying. This isn't asking, do they? This says, in your mind, if you were the king, would a URL that someone types in a web browser resolve or end up displaying the original website?
No, after
expiration.
I'm not talking about this question. I'm just saying in general.
Oh.
It wasn't related to the specific question.
Yeah, but I believe the original intent of this question was asking that question that I just asked. That from a user's perspective, when they type in
I know. I don't disagree with you. This question is specific. I'm talking about other questions. That's all. It's not important.
Yeah. No. But I'm trying to understand the people who said yes or no strong view or other. Why they believe that a name should continue to resolve, for instance. No insights?
Well, Cheryl here. Look,
oh.
I said no strong view either way because, you know, it is a method of saying, hey, guys, guess what? You're expired. But I don't necessarily want to endorse that as the best industry baseline practice. It's you know, very much part of what industry can decide how it wants to do that. But as long as the consumer, the registrant, knows and understands and there's a clear mechanism that, you know, when they pick up the phone and say, what's happened, they can find out what was or wasn't their rights then, even if they haven't read the information and learned about it at the time of contract, which is why I keep coming back to the education being the issue and something that we do need to focus on. You know, registrants should know what their duties are and should know what the consequences of not doing that, like keeping your email address up to date, might happen. So I have no strong view either way.
Ron?
Yes, this is Ron. I was quite hopeful that this survey would allow us to reach some consensus, and by seeing other participants' views, even those who aren't on a particular meeting when something is discussed, would let us understand where the differences are and educate each other as to the positions. Well, in this case, understanding now the clarification of the question, then I would change my response to no if it's permitted to modify the response then.
We have been allowing that.
Okay. So that is my change to no.
So noted.
Thank you.
Any other comments on this particular question? Then let us go on to question 40.
Okay. 40. What should happen to email address to an email address in an expired domain? For example, user@expireddomain.com. Got quite a bit of here. Let's see. 7% attempt to have it delivered to the original mailbox. 36% delivered to some other location specified by the RAE. 14% barred it. 29% bounce it. 14% other. Please specify. And then the other is that don't provide email service at all. Do not resolve. And if bounce means that an MTA returns an error, then that is what is the expected result of an expired domain.
In looking at this, and I've had a number of discussions with people since the survey went out, it's not at all clear, given that one cannot tell from the domain registration what higher-level domains may have mail agents listening at various ports, or even what the protocols are. It's not clear that any of the options to deliver to somewhere else are even implementable. I'm not an expert on this. Maybe if someone else has more information than I do, they could speak up. My understanding is you can really do one of two things. You can attempt, in some cases, to keep on delivering the mail, which some registrars do, or it can simply bounce and say there is no mail service here, and the sending mail agent does whatever they do under appropriate circumstances. Is there anyone here who has a better feeling for the technology than I do and can comment on that? McKaylee?
Basically, you know, technically speaking, it's impossible to know. It's impossible to know what a person is really doing with a domain name unless you have full access to the DNS, to all of the DNS records associated with the domain and any subdomains and any MX records associated with the domain. You've also no way of knowing where the mail is actually going to. So, just to give you a stupid example, if you were to send an email to one of the many domains I own, more likely than not, it'll all end up going to being forwarded on to a different mailbox entirely, because I couldn't be bothered setting up mailboxes for each and every single one of them. I have the mail server configured to send mail to specific users or remote email addresses. So it's to attempt to deliver the mail to anybody is technically not really, it's not feasible technically. I can't see, unless everybody was using mail in a very, very simplistic manner, it just would not be feasible for anybody to implement anything technically that would actually work.
Michele, you started off saying unless you have access to all the DNS records, but I could have simply an A record in DNS which will handle mail in the absence of an MX record, but there's no way that just looking at that A record you could divine that there's a mail agent listening on port 25.
Well, that's exactly. You'd have to have a stupid amount of inside information as to the configuration of the domain, and even the actual domain holder themselves probably wouldn't be able to tell you in many cases what's happening with every single aspect of it, because there's all sorts of crazy things come into play. It's a can of worms that To open that can up would be, I can't see any end to it. From my perspective, you know, if I were to say to my registrants that I was going to try to deliver mail to them, then that would, and then I was to fail to do so, then I would be negligent. So I just would say to my registrant, well, no, I'm not going to attempt to deliver mail anywhere. It's, you know, domain expires, end of. Because, and to do anything else would be insane.
This is Barry.
Go ahead, Barry.
I was just going to say, so I'm certainly the furthest from the most technical person, but I have played around in enterprise email enough, and yeah, it would be a train wreck to even try to implement something if it were even possible. But are there non-technical solutions that we can try to review to mitigate this issue? As an example, and I'm not saying that this would be something that we would put forward or could be put forward, but in the registration process, you know, how difficult would it be to ask for a secondary email address or, you know, at the very least provide an opt-in for a secondary email address? And I would agree before implementing something like that we would want to try to get some stats and figures around, you know, to try to do a cost benefit of even trying to do it. You know, how many registrants out there are not getting notifications because the domain expired and they happen to use that email address for that expired domain. So,
yeah, I think this question was targeted not at the messages telling you your domain expired, but at the regular email traffic that might be associated with the domain name.
Cheryl here. Regardless of that, Alan, I read it with the, you know, having the option for the registrant to give a secondary delivery address. And if they don't, tough. But if it's specified by them, use it. So that's why I said yes. Exactly what Barry was hypothesizing. You know, if the RIE, you know, list an alternate address, then great, and if they don't, tough.
Jeff?
Yeah, I'm just trying to, now I'm even more confused. I wanted some clarification on, I guess, what was the point of the question? Is it what should happen to the email? You know, what should we do to it? Or is it, should we, you know, I'm just confused about what this question, I thought I knew what it was asking, and it said, what should happen to it? And then, you know, should it be bound? Should it be discarded? What should happen to that actual physical email? But I guess it's sort of morphing into another discussion, and now I'm somewhat confused and hoping for some clarification.
If I can try to clarify, the original intent was, this is the equivalent to the web question of when you type in www.blah.com, and the domain has expired, what should happen? What should the user see on the screen? And this is the equivalent question if email is sent to that domain.
Right, but the thing is that...
Not related to the expiration of the domain, but from one innocent user sending some email to the expired domain.
Right, but the point is, I'll just say, and what would that do? I'll just, if I could follow that line of, If I said, if you had it at expireddomain.com, I sent you an email, and you're saying that what you're saying is what should happen to that email if I sent you one to an expired domain?
Yeah.
Is that
if I own expireddomain.com, which happens to be an expired domain, so you send mail to Alan at expireddomain.com.
Right.
You're Jeff, my old friend.
Right.
What should happen?
Okay, so my question to that is anyone on this call as a registrar or other people the decider of what happens to emails that do not, that the person, that does it go, does, I don't believe that as a registrar I make that decision, say discard that email, you know, kill that email. I'm just curious, what can we do to affect it, or are we just, you know, discussing it just for the sake of discussion?
No, I can address that to some extent. If expireddomain.com is
being hosted on a DNS other than the registrar's. So another, another DNS is authoritative. The only way the registrar can take custody back of that domain to put up a flash screen saying this domain has expired or whatever is to change the entry to point to their own DNS.
Right, which
okay.
That is pretty customary.
And chances are they don't have a mail program listening at that port, and the mail will probably bounce saying there is no email there. You know, the host does not exist. On the other hand, in talking to James, he said that if the domain name is hosted on GoDaddy's web server, or on GoDaddy's DNS, all they do is change the A record. If there's an MX record, it stays, in which case the mail would continue to be delivered. So that, those are the two extremes of what might happen.
Okay.
In today's world.
And then I just, if you don't mind, I'm just curious, what would, just as to the point of this group, if the email went through, how would that help post-expiration domain name recovery? So if you, I sent you that email to expired domain, you got it, how would that make any difference? Or I'm just curious, reflections in you knowing your domain's expired or helping you recover it or anything that...
I'll answer on my own behalf. I'll answer my own behalf and then let Michaeli speak.
Sure.
If I had a domain on GoDaddy that behaved the way it does if it's hosted on GoDaddy's domain service and the email continued to be delivered, if this was a domain which I only used for email, I would see no indication that it had expired. And I personally think that's the wrong way to handle it.
Okay.
I think it should go, quote, go dark just like the website should, you know, euphemistically. But
right,
that,
so then,
that's what the question was trying to get at.
And then, sorry if I just entertain me for one more second. So then if we did that and it went dark, which I can understand, is the registrar the one that can say it gets kicked back to you that this email address does not exist, or is it the mail program that determines that? That's what I'm not clear about. I'm actually not sure of the answer to that question, if somebody else can answer that.
The answer is it depends on how you have your SMTP agents set up. If you don't have an SMTP agent, the sender will say it. If you do have one, they may bounce it. Michaeli?
Well, if there's no MX, if there's no MX record, it'll come back with a host not found most of the time. So it won't, because if you don't, well, it depends on the mail, on the mail servers in question. But while the spammers will try A records, properly behaved RFC compliant mailers won't. They'll generally go just for the MX records. I mean, the problem here is I think there's, the people are confusing two questions. One of the questions which we were discussing was about the email address being used for sending the notifications to. So, for example, I have the domain mnalem.com. The registrant email address for mnalem.com is michaeli@mnalem.com. It's also the registrant address for a lot of my other domains. So what some people were saying was that it would be a good idea to have a second email address or something associated with the account I have at the registrar to send notifications to regarding the upcoming expiration and afterwards and all that. And I'd agree wholeheartedly with Alan that if the mail is still being delivered to the user on a domain that's effectively expired, they're probably not going to realize that the domain has expired if they've been ignoring all the other notifications. I don't know what about the other registrars, but I know from our own experience that a disproportionate number of our users only use their domains for mail. They don't use them for anything else. I mean, they might have a website, but I mean, the website was probably put up in 1996, and it hasn't really changed ever since. So I wouldn't really count that. Where I mean, I know for a fact that if our primary mail cluster has a hissy fit. But that's a hissy fit is the technically acceptable term, of course. For anything longer than about 35 seconds, we will probably get 500 to 600 phone calls within the space of 10 minutes. And this is assuming that we've actually resolved the issue with the mail server within 5 to 10 minutes. So, I mean, whereas if I turned off our web servers for an hour a day, only a tiny proportion of our clients would even notice. So I think affecting the email delivery is key to make getting people to understand, yes, your domain is dead. There's something wrong with it. You need to contact somebody and fix it. How the SMTP agents and all that handle the mail, it, obviously there is going to be a certain degree of variance in certain setups and what have you. There might be variations, but working on the basis that, you know, at expiration, the registrar is probably going to change the name servers to be either their own name servers if they weren't previously, or in the cases of some registrars, they'll change them to being specific name servers that they use for expired domain names. Then the mail service will cease to function. I don't know of anybody who does it otherwise, and maybe GoDaddy do it differently, but I don't work for them, so I can't comment on that.
Yeah, I could only comment on them because I had that explicit discussion with James. Any other comments before we go ahead? I'd like to go on to talk about Brussels and how we go forward sooner rather than later. But let's try to do one more.
Okay. We're on 13, right? Are you of the opinion that expiration-related provisions in typical registration agreements are clear and conspicuous enough? Example, are you of the opinion that registrants understand and are able to find renewal and expiration-related information easily? And the answer was 27% said yes, 33% said no, 20% said no strong view either way.
And 20 said other.
Okay, let me stand up. That's right, 20 said other. And in the other, we've got some categories. We're not sure if the agreement is key here at all. They may be able to find it if they try, but they probably don't know where to look. And this question was discussed during the meetings and has a difficulty of defining typical.
Okay. I think this is a good one. Oh, sorry, we have Jeff with a comment.
Oh, sure, Alan, I'll let you finish if you want to say what you were about to say. Go ahead.
I was going to say such a divided question seems to be a good one to end on, where we're not going to come to any strong answer regardless of what anyone's opinions are. But, Jeff, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with you. This one is a tough one because we all know what's clear and conspicuous for one person might not be clear and conspicuous for another person. But actually, I had a question, and I'd like to know just on when people answer this, I don't mean to be putting anyone on the spot, so if you don't want to answer, that's fine. But the people who answered no on those, could you let me know, to the group, which agreements you used as your typical registration agreements and what you read in those agreements that you found that it was not clear or conspicuous? I would just love to know. I'd just like to know so we can get a general understanding because, you know, that is something that in my registration agreement as, you know, it's not a part of the RAA. It's something that as a registrar I can change. So if you could say, here are the ones that we found that were clear. When I answered this question, I read a few. These are the ones I did, or hopefully that people didn't just answer this based on, like, anecdotal evidence and, you know, other thoughts or hearing or feelings. So it doesn't necessarily have to be on this call, but if you could distribute to the list and say, when I answered this question, these are the ones that I thought were not clear and conspicuous. If that might be able to help. As registrars, we could help change that.
Okay, I'll certainly answer that to the list if I don't remind me. McKaylee?
Yeah, I mean, my comments there is, I mean, the thing, I suppose, it's back to the education thing. What is or isn't in a registration agreement probably isn't the key issue. It's a case of whether people are made aware of what will happen. And that's the key thing. It doesn't matter really. I mean, okay, the registration agreement is something which is easier in some respects to look at, but as long as people are being made aware of the fact that, you know, if you do not renew your domain, X, Y, and Z will happen or you will lose this functionality, then that actually addresses the problem. I mean, my entire problem with a lot of the stuff to do with the post-expiry is, as far as I'm concerned, the issue isn't with what happens after the domain has expired. It's all, most of the problems seem to be addressable before the domain expires.
I wasn't going to give an answer to Jeff's question, but I will give a very brief one because of what you said, and I agree with what you said. The part that I had, I wasn't trying to answer the conspicuous enough. I was trying to answer, I was addressing my answer to clear. And a registration agreement which says, after expiration, the domain may or may not continue to point to your website. We may or may not change who is. We may or may not transfer the website, the ownership to somebody else.
Is not clear.
Is not clear. And it doesn't address what I think Michele just said of understanding what will happen when it expires. And that was the kind of thing that I was answering. I can't speak to anyone else. Helen?
Yeah, what I'm wondering is, as a registrar myself, I would say that about 0.01% or probably even less of our registrants ever look at the registration agreement. It is necessarily a legal document. It's long-winded, and we have to kind of cover everything. So really, it boils down to what Michele says. We have to inform our registrants more directly, you know, renew the domain or you'll lose it, and keep up your email addresses. Otherwise, we may not send renewal notices to you, and they ignore us at their peril if that's what they do. But getting too excited about registration agreements seems to be a waste of time for the average registrant, unless we can find some way to make a legal document very short, clear, and concise. And to date, I have not been able to do that.
Does Barry May get in the queue?
Sure. Go ahead.
I would tend to agree with Helen's comments as well, and I believe that it was even somebody had posted on this group a while back some documents that were done down in Australia, I believe, that kind of that was you. Anyway, it was a very great attempt at trying to numb down the language of a registration agreement by providing kind of examples between the language and stuff. And I'm not saying we necessarily need to go down that road or not, but certainly a common theme that is developing here is the education component of the registrants. And I strongly do feel that one of the primary recommendations out of this group is, you know, what platform, what method can we do to increase the street IQ of registrants? And, you know, perhaps it's something, I think we had mentioned it before, that there's ICANN-sponsored education or videos and different kinds of things where we can educate the registrants about the specifics that would normally show up in a registrant agreement that kind of dumbs it down for them to absorb and understand. And while I think it would be an interesting exercise to try to clean up registrant agreements to make them plain language, I just don't know how practical that is, especially within the legal world. Thank you.
I think we need to institute a domain owner's license. Until you pass the test, you can't buy a domain. Michele?
Just picking up on Barry's thing there about the education thing. I mean, ICANN has recently started a series of podcasts to, you know, educate the world about the workings of ICANN. And, you know, it's great that they're doing it, but I think it's this kind of basic stuff to do with domains that ICANN are in a position to put out information that is, you know, quite neutral. It's coming from a supposedly trusted source. So maybe in their podcast series they can look at these kind of things. I mean, and this doesn't cost much. I mean, how much does it cost to produce a podcast? You're just recording somebody's voice talking about whatever, and, you know, just disseminate that more readily. I mean, a lot of the problems that we're dealing with, both in this working group and in other working groups, could probably be addressed through making people more aware of you know, the basic realities of, you know, if you register a domain for 5 years, in year six you will not have use of that unless you have paid for the renewal. Because we still get we still get registrants who seem to think that it's absolutely shocking and terrible that we would expect them to pay a renewal fee for their domain name. They think that's absolutely crazy. I mean, how on earth could we possibly do that? And of course, if they don't pay for it, then of course the domain stops working, and then they're very, very upset.
Wait, we have to renew our domains?
That's right.
Jeez, no one told us that. Helen?
Yeah, I actually agree with Michele. The podcasts are sort of useful and interesting. But basically, any registrant that's going to all that trouble to try and educate themselves probably doesn't really have a lot of these problems working out whether they have to renew domains or not. We're talking about the average registrar that Michele was talking about, the registrant that is unsure. I registered a domain 10 years ago. Why does it belong to this person? This is upsetting. Give me my domain back. These people don't know very much. They don't want to know very much. They don't want to look at the stuff. So really all we can do is the registrar sends them basic information at the time and hope they pay attention to it. But asking them to educate themselves, they're not going to want to spend the time.
I think a lot of the reality is that the people who have the most problems are the ones who don't even get it by a domain name.
That's probably true.
They sign an agreement for a web hosting, and these people give them a, quote, free domain name. And there is no opportunity then for go to listen to an ICANN podcast. They don't even know what ICANN is, and they probably don't even know what a registrar is. And that's
all
where
what
the
domain name
show
is.
Up.
Yeah, Alan, if yep. I may, to that end, I've put in at least what AUDA has done to try and rectify that, which is, as a trusted source, a very, in fact, humorous, enjoyable, and it's even fun to listen in the car if you're just wanting to keep yourself awake driving between Melbourne and Sydney, set of podcasts, which are, if one does actually find their way to AUDA site, can be self-education tools, but more importantly, are tools that we expect, encourage, and spend a lot of time talking to the world of an inverted commas trusted advisor, the host, the web hosters, the lawyers, the accountants, the people to whom mum and pop organisations go and say, this interweb thing, how do we get on that? These resources for these people to pass on. It makes them look good. It helps them, in inverted commas, look like they know what they're doing and educate their, in inverted commas, client. But it subtly passes a message that says, and by the way, you're actually, you know, engaging in this interesting world, which is, you know, got a whole lot of pitfalls and interesting opportunities.
Indeed. Margie?
I just wanted to follow up on the podcast idea. That works when everything is standard. So, I mean, you know, to provide general overview of the registration process, where the registrars have discretion on how they deal with things at expiration, like if the site's down or whatever, that doesn't resolve, wouldn't have that information. And so the kind of the day-to-day information that a registrant who's found themselves in that situation, you know, they won't be able to get that information from a podcast. But, you know, so I see the value of podcasts for standard things that I can educate, but when it comes to registrar specific things, we just don't have that access to that information.
Michele?
I'd have to disagree with Margie. I mean, we're not talking about dealing with stuff in such a way that you address every single possible variation of business models. I mean, you're talking about basics. That, you know, check to make sure that the who is data on your domain is correct. Check that the contacts associated with it are correct. These are all things that are pretty much universal. And, you know, that to say something like your domain may be at risk if you do not renew us is not stating something which is going to have any real negative effect in relation to various different business models. Because unless unless, I don't know, Network Solutions, ourselves, and all the other registrars suddenly decide that we've absolutely no interest in money, we're not suddenly going to start paying for domain renewals if we're not getting paid by the users. So I would have to respectfully disagree, Marjorie. I think that in many respects, ICANN is in a better position to provide kind of general information on these kind of things than a lot of other people. And the example that Cheryl linked to is a very, very good example of you know, the regulator or whatever they wish to describe themselves as, using that position of trust to educate everybody.
Okay. I'm going to give the microphone to Paul, but I really would like to leave a few minutes to talk about future steps. Paul?
Great. Thanks, Alan. Really quick, just to agree with what Michele said and looking at the what's in the chat from Cheryl and Michele as well, I think there is an opportunity here, and I look at like what ICANN did, what staff did to provide a layman's understanding of the RAA, you know, the document that kind of boils everything down, takes out the legalese.
We did that.
Yeah, you know, doing it like that, so you as Cheryl's saying, you pitch it at the right level, it can just touch on the important points. Many of the things that we're saying we feel that need to be done here could be done in the podcast, and leverage ICANN's sort of neutral position in all this. Yes, they're, you know, I won't use the R word, they're not a regulator, but, you know, whatever, they've got that special role in the industry. They're not pushing anybody. They don't know need to know the absolute details about every particular registrar's practices, but there's probably really something here that should be, you know, a closer look be given, because if not ICANN, who?
We really do need to think somewhere along the way about how we handle the situation that I mentioned, that is someone signing up for a web hosting agreement and ticking off a box to get a free domain name, which is the terminology that is often used. So,
they usually think it's, you know, yeah.
Well, but that's what's happening right now, and that's where most of the complaints come from, ultimately.
I understand. Yep.
Okay, we have 5 minutes. Hopefully we won't go too much over. How do we take what we have right now? And as I said, I sent out a synopsis of the previous ones. I'll do it again for this one once the transcript is posted. How do we go forward and start drafting something so we can start soliciting comments? We've spent an awful lot of time in this process, and I really would like, from my personal point of view, I'd like to see something come out of this, and that our time has been spent productively, and that ICANN won't, 3 years from now, have to start this process all over again. Any quick thoughts? Ron?
Yeah, just there was a discussion earlier about whether this survey would be in a public survey before we tried to generate the consensus. Is that off the table now?
I don't think there's enough time to do something like that. It would require a fair amount of work to rework the survey and then get it done. If people, there was a general consensus that we should go ahead with that, and I would like to think we could do that in parallel, or perhaps as part of the initial report we do. If there's a strong feeling that we should do it prior to that, we can do it, but that almost guarantees that we don't do anything for Brussels, in as my understanding of the time.
Yes, I would agree that it's an either or.
I certainly think that we have enough items that there was reasonable consensus on that we could start putting together some sort of plan on where to go from here. That doesn't mean we don't address some of the other more marginal issues as we go along, but I think there's some meat that we can talk about where there has been either a large consensus or a strong feeling, albeit with some minority views. Margie, do you know when, or you do know, when is Marika back?
I think she's back by the end of this week, so next week.
Oh, I thought she was going for 2 weeks. Okay.
Well, let me check.
Okay.
Yeah, I thought it was because she left early last week, so you might be thinking of that. She was out.
So this mail I got from her on Monday was not really from her. Okay.
Yeah, she's actually working. She sends emails on vacation once in a while. So.
I love diligent people, but they're crazy. Is there anyone in this group who would like to sort of as a side effort spend some time talking about how do we go forward and what to do as next steps? I think it would be more productive to put a proposal to the group rather than trying to develop it in this group as a whole. Paul?
Yeah, thanks, Alan. I'd agree that it'd be more productive to work off a document. To that end, since Marika's not here this week and we'll need time to listen to the call and then some time to put it together, could I make a motion that we skip next week's meeting to give her time to do that, and then we come back whatever 2 weeks from today is?
I would tend to agree, but with the caveat that we probably don't have the luxury of skipping many more meetings after that, because we'll only have about a little bit over a month until we have to start producing something for Brussels. But I'm willing to take the next week and do some work in the background. If Paul, since you put your hand up, I'll ask you if you're one of those who is willing to work on something. And Cheryl, you wanted to say something, or were you volunteering?
Oh, no, I'm not volunteering.
Oh, dear.
In fact, quite the opposite. I was saying that with the weird and wonderful world of accountability and transparency review team starting in my life at the end of this week, my available space is going to suddenly shrink rapidly. But I certainly would prefer to have a document to work on, because being involved in the ANT is not going to stop me being involved in these other work group activities within the world of the GNSO and CCNSO. So, yeah, having a document would be a great step forward. I certainly support the skip one and give time for a draft that we can then go through to be prepared. But what I was going to suggest is that the document be along the lines of, based on not only our deliberations, but drawing extensively on where consensus or where lack of consensus is obvious from this internal survey tool, is that we put in general and generic terms, the work group so far has, you know, discovered this, 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 this and this as issues that clearly need to be looked at further, need to be discussed, perhaps need to be, you know, blah, 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 you know, just a review synopsis, but that we do run then in parallel with whatever we do with that document, put it out for comment or work with it in Brussels, a public or a more public set of survey questions, having learnt from the ambiguity and misinterpretation and indeed some of the questions just shouldn't be asked at all experience, so that when we are seeking and encouraging feedback on whatever report we put out, there are some guided and clear questions, not guided in the answers, but guided in the focal point that we're asking the inverted commas public to respond to.
Okay. On the issues where we have moderately large consensus, would you want to see in the report, in the draft report, alternative ways of addressing whatever the issue is?
If that can be wrought into it without seemingly, so options A, B, C, and D type, rather than trying to look as if we're putting things in ironclad form at this stage, yes.
No, I specifically said options, not a recommendation.
Yeah, I want to keep well away from recommendations, but options, yeah, because then we can get a temperature taking done from the wider community on some of those.
Exactly, because presumably if we do a draft report of some sort, we can put it out for formal public comment or an informal one. Does that sound like a reasonable way to go forward, given that we're 2 minutes over time?
Agreed.
All right. And then I will put out a call on our list for anyone else who wants to work with me on that. And barring that, I may finger a few people particularly.
Alan, I wondered how long is it likely for us to need to spend on the final two questions in the survey, because there is only two left.
Oh, sorry. I hadn't really looked how much there was to go.
You know, if it's going to cost another 5 minutes of my day, I'm more than happy to sacrifice it right now.
All right. No one's dropped off. Let's try to do it quickly. Margie, are you still here?
Yeah, I'm fine. You want to do the last two?
Sure, why not?
Okay, all right.
I just like a small benchmark, a little tick in the box.
You just want to finish something.
Oh, please.
Okay, so now we're down to 42. You need to specify what happens to non-web, non-email services post-expiration, i.e., should ICANN specify what happens to all IP ports or just those specific to web and email services? So you've got 20% saying yes, 33% saying no, 20% saying no strong view either way, and then 20% with other. And in the other, we have yes, all services should stop. And then the other comment is registration and DNS has nothing whatsoever to do with port 80 or 25.
I find that interesting. Mikey's answer of yes, everything should stop under other is exactly why I said yes under yes. So clearly we need to word our questions a little bit clearer. McKaylee.
It's similar to my take on the email thing. Again, you have no way of knowing how many hosts, records of different types exist. So there's no way you could possibly specify every single possible service that could be hanging off a domain name or an A record or an SVR record or a TXT record or any of the other wonderful records that exist or could potentially exist now or in the future within the DNS. So
that's why
I said no.
Other than to say nothing shall work with the possible exception of port 80 and a splash screen.
Well, if you're even going to say that, but I mean, I think it's just, it's opening up a can of worms because you're saying port 80 is going to work. The question then is, for which A record? So let's say, for example, the example I use sometimes, if you go to log.ie, you'll see a parking page. You think, oh my God, that domain's parked. If you go to b.log.ie, you get to a website.
Mm-hmm. But that's a problem every registrar faces today and addresses one way or another, either by ignoring it or by taking action.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying is if you start specifying it, if you specify one thing, you're opening up a can of worms, because then it's like, you know, why don't you specify another, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, that's my thinking on it anyway.
I guess my perspective is the web, the entire domain that is at the second level should be taken over, and it shouldn't work with the possible exception of the web because we have some, quote, acquired rights that registrars are used to at this point.
I think the thing there, though, Alan, is, I mean, if I say, for example, I can't speak for the other registrars, but, for example, on our parking system, it's not, it's just all the domains get directed to a parking service within the system. So it's just the host header bit that specifies whether anything is going to be specific to that particular domain. So it's not actually the service related to the domain, if that kind of makes sense to you.
I don't think it makes any difference to me.
Okay.
Ron?
Yes, with that clarification, I'm saying yes. So my other can be changed to yes.
All right. Clearly, we've learned something about how to word these questions. Margie, last question.
Okay. All right, 17. Do you feel that ICANN should put in place rules that such clarity is required for all registration agreements?
I'm not sure what the context of this is.
Yeah, it probably follows number 16, whatever number 16 was.
What is the role? What role is there for ICANN in this process, which follows 15, which is what measures could or should be taken to facilitate understanding of expiration-related provisions by registrants? So what measures can be taken? What role should ICANN take And what rules do you think ICANN should put in place? I think the answer is suitably fuzzy.
Right, 30% yes, 30% no, 30% no strong view either way, and then 10% other, and the other is, the question is vague.
And I think we should stop before anyone has a chance to upset the beautiful symmetry of 30-30-30 by changing their vote.
I like the fact that some people just didn't even answer that question. They too were tired by the whole thing.
I'm sorry. Well, this was in the middle, so they couldn't have been tired.
Maybe they were.
I'm one of the ones who didn't answer that question, and I claim it was a survey fault that I wasn't asked. I'm absolutely positive of it, as a matter of fact. No, in fact, I think this is one of the ones that was contingent on a previous one, but it doesn't
matter.
It was.
Yeah. It was. If you said one thing, then goes the other. Hmm.
Blaming the technology always works.
Hmm.
Just prior to the selective impact therapy. All right, no one's laughing. This meeting has clearly gone on far too long. Mikey, you're supposed to at least laugh at your own jokes.
Michaeli needs to say something, though.
Michaeli?
It comes back again to the education thing, really. I mean, I think ICANN's place, as far as I'm concerned, it should be able to use its position to help educate people in general terms. I mean, getting bogged down... I think the reason why I would have said no is because the question specifically related to registration agreements. And as we've already discussed ad nauseum, getting absolute clarity into registration agreements is going to be a problem because they're a legal document. But it should have a role in helping to educate people, as in the public in general. And, you know, again... hat tip to Cheryl for that link. I think that's something that ICANN staff should look at.
I'll raise a question to the group, not wanting an answer at this point. How can ICANN get involved without the active participation of the intermediaries that are really the people that registrants deal with? That is, the registrars, the resellers, and web hosters. Because ICANN is an abstract thing that's very far away from them at the time they need this information. And again, I'm not sure we can answer that question now, but think about it, because it really does involve the other players getting involved in the process, if only to put a pointer somewhere. Ron?
Yeah, I would just say this education thing has been going on even before Network Solutions had anything to do with the Internet. I mean, it was proposed as part of InterNIC way, way back, and so it's a long-standing need.
And it's way overdue.
Any parting comments before we adjourn? In the absence of them, thank you very much, everyone. Thank you very much, Margie. And we'll see you in 2 weeks. And a few of you will see before then.
Bye
bye.
See you guys.
Bye.